you very much, and welcome to another trip round the BBC Word Sanctuary with our two teams of distinguished word watchers, Dilys Power and Frank Muir, Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norton. And we start with a round of regional variations. In different parts of Britain, these words mean the same thing or are varieties of the same thing. Frank, four words for you. Scribs, croggies, skinch and blobs.
Looks to me like pimples. But
I'm giving you a visual clue. I'm putting one finger over the other on the same hand.
I can't do those.
Did you never do that as a boy? And shout
Pecs.
Some... Yes.
Phenites.
Yes. So, what are these scribs?
It means, don't hit me, and peace.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Two marks to Frank.
And without help.
Imagine being in a school where they said scrinch or blobs. Yes. And you're saying packs.
Yes.
It.
Yes, you're having to go through the repertory until they stop hitting you. You get the right one. They're called children's truce words. Anyway, that's what they are. Antonia, frackens, myrtles, farn-tickles, and summer voys, V-O-Y-S.
Oh, blobs, Michael.
I think we'll give you a bonus for that. These actually are more noticeable usually on summer girls and on summer boys. Just frackens, myrtles, farn tickles, sorts of things that come out in the sunshine.
Oh, freckles.
Well done, freckles, without any help. There's what we doctors and our technical jargon call small brown spots. Dilys, cobble-ducks. Cobble ducks, sarsens, S-A-R-S-E-N-S, muffeties and whivets.
It's not the language I usually use.
They're lovely words, though.
Very nice, I know. Cobble ducks, I know.
If you had one or two of these loose, you might need to see a psychiatrist.
Yes.
There's an awful lot of sibilance going on in the audience.
It's a form of drink.
It's sense. It's sense.
No, I'll put you out of your agony.
They're
different sizes of roofing slates.
Oh, well, of course. It's so obvious.
I've given up roofing.
Yes, we heard slates all over the audience.
No, they said screws.
Well, I don't know why you're laughing, Dennis. We'll take the smile off your face with Corry Flug, Cuddy Wifted, Pally Clukit, and Marlborough. The first three hyphenated, and I'll give you them again. Corry Flug, Cuddy Wifted, Pally Clukit, and Marlborough.
You always give them the easy ones.
Basically, there are people all over the world tuning into this programme under the belief they're learning English. they've all got slang. The most ribald terms in slang are for certain conditions. One is drunk. Is it? He was real cuddy-wifted, or you're... or came home absolutely pally-clucket last night. or pregnant.
I think
she's pally-clucket. Is it?
No, but it could... I mean, it's an interesting idea.
Marlborough is the one that...
Yeah. It's a sinister physical characteristic.
Left-handed.
Well done. Yeah. Two marks for that. I hope you notice I'm being very firm today. No real helpful clues. Now, before we go on to round two, here, Frank and Dennis, are the quotations you were given for the last round. Frank's is Rose of Washington Square, certainly a song and I think an Alice Faye film title. And Dennis's is The End Justifies the Means. Meanwhile, we have one of those rounds that tend to cause trouble, not just for our teams, but for the chairman, defining the differences. Frank, can you detect any difference in meaning between allay and alleviate?
I'll tell you what, you as a medical man, may I use a medical analogy?
Yes, too, yes.
If you wanted to allay a condition, you'd prescribe a tonic. And if you wish to alleviate, you prescribe an aspirin.
Two aspirin would get you 2 marks. They'll give you 2 marks. Absolutely right. 2 marks for 2 aspirin. These are always a matter of discussion, as we know. I think it's the element of healing that comes in to alleviate. And allay is to lay down, as in lay down your arms, set aside, repress, annul. Antonia, difference between assuage and appease.
Well, appease is perfectly straightforward. You bring about peace. You bring everybody into a state of peace, which on the whole, perhaps not in the 30s, but on the whole is a very good state. Assuage is much closer, really, to alleviate, isn't it?
Well, don't let's get into that.
Will you just give me the marks and I'll run?
No, I might say that in the shorter Oxford Dictionary, each is used as, to define the other.
I knew it.
It's one of these marvellous ones. I think we'll give Antonia 2 marks and look for Dillis's definition.
Yes, I would, yes.
Dillis, the difference between solid and stolid, apart from the fact that one's got a T in it, no marks for that.
I was going to say that.
Solid is applied to a physical condition, and stolid is a psychological reaction or form, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, you could say that a piece of earth was solid, but you wouldn't say it was stolid, and you could say that a man's reactions to danger were stolid.
And what would they have been? If he was stolid, how would he react to danger? That's all we want to know.
He would behave very calmly.
He's had an aspirin.
Collectively, like all of us.
This is after taking the aspirin. Yeah. Well done. two marks for you. Just to give you the boring definitions that you find in the dictionary, solid is free from empty spaces. Stolid, dull, impassive, insensible, incapable of being excited or moved. Which applies to every examiner before whom I ever appeared. Dennis, difference between inescapable and ineluctable.
Ineluctable, one of those words I don't use very often, but from merely having read it, I would say inescapable means you can't escape from it by any means, but ineluctable means you can't escape by fighting against it. But presumably the door is open to negotiation or something like that. I mean, that's what I would gather. I wouldn't, I wouldn't put more than about 40p on it.
No, well, you get 2 marks for 40p. It's a good rate. Inescapable is that which cannot be avoided, is inevitable. Ineluctable, that which you cannot escape by struggling. Next round is a question of style. Noel Coward, asked to give examples of what he considered to have style, suggested, among other things, a candy-striped jeep, the colour white, a seagull, the evasion of boredom, a Brixham trawler, and the Paris Opera House. It just shows how quickly fashions can change.
Yeah.
Can you suggest, giving reasons for your choice, other objects, states of mind, personalities, anything which, in your opinion, possesses this ephemeral quality called style? Frank.
Do you think Noel Coward was asked to provide examples? He was paid to provide examples. It was a commercial in New York, wasn't it?
Was it? Mm. I thought it was possibly rung up late at night by a newspaper.
But I'm reminded of a friend of ours who had two small sons at school, junior school, they were sort of 6 and 7, and they had a friend home for the weekend, also sort of 6 or 7, and she was trying to feed them breakfast and get her husband off to work, and this is about 8:30, and the kitchen was filling with smoke from the burnt bacon and things. She was charging around and trying to get... And the small boy guest, 6 or 7, suddenly said, "Excuse me, Mrs. Hollis, but you appear to have forgotten the butter knife." that to me is style. Definition of a gentleman used to be somebody who uses a butter knife when he's alone.
Antonio, your
one definition.
Antonio, your definition of
when
style.
I encountered true style quite early in life when I went from my parents' sober, not to say parsimonious, home to work as what would now be called a kind of au pair for a very jolly bohemian lady, and she gave a party. And the drink arrived, and I said, "The drink's arriving, what shall I do with it?" And she said, "Oh, put it in the bath, my dear." Well, as you could imagine, I did put it in the bath. I put the plug in, I was very careful, and I poured all the drink in the bath, because I was used to obey, and for all I knew, that's what you did with drink. And when she came in and saw it, I've never forgotten it, she said, "Well, then we'll just have to drink it as it is."
I think you both show great style there. Dillis, style.
Style, I only think of it in writing. It seems to me that style in writing is choosing the inescapable word, the word which really means precisely what you mean and can't mean anything else. I mean, when Shakespeare says... to be or not to be. To be is precise. I mean, it isn't to live or to exist. It's to be. It's nothing else. And you can't use any other word which is as precisely right.
So I'll certainly buy that. People who don't do it think it's easy. Dennis.
I'm using it in the sense that Noel Coward had it. And as you say, all those examples seem to have dated. I think because they apply to things, and things very rarely have an intrinsic style. They're the attitude we bring to them. I think people who, like Antonio's, that outrageousness is what I find attractive. One associates with Aristotle, that French aristocrats tipping the guillotine operator, you know, and things like that. But it doesn't have to be. I remember reading about an American gangster, one of these very big mobsters who was finally caught up with after having acquired an enormous fortune and sentenced to 6 months for tax evasion, and his lawyers struggling every inch of the way, and finally he had to go to prison for this 6 months, so he drove there in a taxi and told the driver to wait.
So we move on to a round now, which Peter Moore calls definitely definitive. What word is defined as follows in the concise Oxford English Dictionary? Frank, your definition. The faculty of making happy and unexpected discoveries by accident.
It's the most beautiful word and a thing I totally believe in, invented by Horace Walpole in the late 18th century, when he wrote a story about three princes of Serendip, which is the old word of Ceylon, who went on an expedition and on the way accidentally attracted good things to them. And it's called, the word is serendipity, because it's this marvellous thing. It's what you get if you go to the London Library rather than the British Library, because the London Library has open shelves and you're looking for one book. And on the way, you accidentally come across two even more valuable to what you're looking for. Serendipity. Wonderful part of life.
2 marks for Frank. Antonio, this is the definition. Wax-like substance found in intestines of sperm whale.
Well, isn't that ambergris?
That'll get you 2 marks. Well done.
Which is the... Because it's the basis of all perfume, isn't it? It
used to be used once in cooking, according to the larger Oxford Dictionary. Dillis, here's your definition. of or designed to aid the memory.
To aid the memory?
Yes.
Nothing aids mine these days.
Well, let me give
mnemonic.
You...
mnemonic.
Somebody in my rather deaf left ear said mnemonic.
Well, that'll mnemonic. If you turn it into mnemonic, you'll get 2 marks. Well done. Dennis, be careful now. This is your definition. To make love, especially in a trifling manner.
Especially in a trifling
manner. Allowed to make...
Is it the old-fashioned meaning of make love, or the newfangled?
The old-fashioned.
Philander.
Philander, well done. Let's turn to your quotation, Frank. Which is Rose of Washington Square.
Rose of Washington Square. I take you to a fairly sort of warm Thursday in 1805 off the Cape of Trafalgar. And we are on the ship Victory, and Admiral Nelson has gone down to the chart room to meet Captain Hardy and have a cup of tea and a chart. And the Spanish and the French fleet are looming on the horizon. And they sit there talking, and Nelson says, Hardy, I want to make a signal. Get the signal flags out. And at dawn, I want to make a signal. England expects that every man will do. And Hardy said, Well, the trouble is, sir, that we haven't got signal flags. So we had the signal flags, but we haven't got signal flags now. And Nelson said, well, why haven't you got signal flags, Hardy? You're the signals captain. What's the point of a signals captain without any signals? And he said, well, sir, it doesn't necessarily follow. You can be a vice captain, sir, and be a sidesman. And Nelson said, well, what happened to the signal flags? And Hardy said, well, it was the mayor of Portsmouth, sir. They're having the church fete. And he asked us if he could lend them some bunting. And I lent him the signal flags. And I said, don't lend him. What are we going to do? And he said, well, we would have to borrow some from one of the other ships, which are hard astern. Hardy said, we can't, sir. It's in Queen's regulations. We've got to have signal flags or we get 1,000 lashes each and keel hauled. It's restrictions, sir. And I said, well, this is very, very, very difficult. And Hardy was perturbed. And he said, sir, there's a little boat just back of us. I'll ask her whether she's... I'll borrow the signal flags from her. So he said, boat, may I borrow your signal flags? Now, the point is, this boat, it was the Saucy Mrs. Flobster, incidentally, which was a mercantile boat. The Saucy Mrs. Flobster was in trouble, actually. They had a lot of trouble on board already. The bows were stove in when they had a collision just off Lisbon with a jellyfish. And they'd had trouble when they left Portsmouth. For one thing, the captain has flogged the flags to the mayor of Portsmouth for his fate, the signal flags, that is. And then they had a woman on board. Now, she was actually a blanchisseuse. She was a laundry woman called Nancy. And that's what happened when the ship made shore, like Portsmouth. The laundry woman would come on and she'd do the captain's curtains and the his bed clothes. And when they left Portsmouth, they discovered that she'd also done a bunk. So the captain they called, they're a very friendly crew, they called Skip, because he was full of rubbish. And Skip made Nancy his first mate. He was terribly shy. And the skipper and Nancy were on the bridge when this shout came, avast behind! They were in the middle of the British fleet. They said, we want your flags. And Nancy said, we haven't got any flags, Skip. No, we sold them to the mayor of Portsmouth. He said, oh, no. She said, oh, no, I'll tear up the washing. So he said, hang on a moment, sir, and more, sir. We're just coming with our signal flags. And she got all the crew to take their shirts off, and she went down to all the washing in the tub, and she tore the sleeves off and just left the geometrical patterns, and he spent the whole evening dabbing them into the colours of the various signal flags. And in the morning, when the signal was hoisted on HMS Victory, it was there again, line upon line of apparently signal flags saying England expects that every man will do his duty. They were not signal flags. What were they? Rows of washing torn square.
Evoked a very satisfactory groan, I thought, that one. Dennis, the end justifies the means. Not in Latin, that's no, the translation.
The end justifies... It's a line that more or less sums up the quandary that Frank and I find ourselves placed in every week with these stories. What's it better to do? To rack our brains in search of a really tortured final line, like the one that elicited groans there, or go for a simple twist at the end and concentrate on making the tale that leads up to it as interesting as possible. Because what happens sometimes, you see, is that you place all your hopes on the final line, only to find that getting to it proves so lengthy and tedious that you start suffering what could be described as the loneliness of the long-distance punner. A case in point could be a story that I was embroidering recently about what happened when my wife and I went to one of those enormous bedding warehouses in search of something suitable for stuffing a duvet. Now, what they recommended was something called goose down. A bit expensive, but they stressed that it was important not to use too much because an overstuffed duvet apparently raises the temperature of the bed to a point where unusual things can start happening. And to help their customers take the right amount of down, there were three sets of scales for you to weigh the stuff on. Well, while we were waiting for a set of scales to become vacant, who should I spot but one of our oldest friends, a girl called Eva. Can't remember her second name, Eva. I was going over to her to have a chat with her, two of the scales became available. One of them right next to where Eva was standing. Which meant, and here it comes, I was able to turn to my wife and say, weigh down upon this one near Eva. Now, didn't that way... It's better if you sing it, actually. But that's the point of way down to Washington Square. But didn't that seem an interminable length of time before I got to that extremely feeble last line? Have you ever in your life heard anything as teeth-achingly boring as the story I had to plough through to accommodate it, you see? But that, as I say, is our weekly dilemma. Just how dull can a story be before its very tedium destroys the line it's leading to? I mean, there'd be no difficulty if the preamble to it could be reasonably brief, as with a tale that's been knocking around my mind for quite a while now about a lady with the job of selling timeshares in holiday properties on a group of islands in the West Indian Ocean, and how she decides to set up her shop near a children's playground. Her purpose, of course, being to use as her slogan, she sells Seychelles near the seesaw. Another idea I had to discard as being too short concerned an amateur operatic society who cancelled their Christmas production of Amal and the Night Visitors in order to allow the hall to be booked for a one-man show by the well-known My Music panellist, John Amis, on the theory, as you probably guessed, that Amis is as good as Amal. Now, at that length, you see, it's a doddle. But because these stories have to run at least 4.5 minutes, what one gets forced into are such interminable anecdotes, as one of the latest I've hatched up is about a suburban housewife who has had a Scandinavian lover called Leif Erikson. And this Leif Erikson got into the habit of staying the night whenever her husband was away on business. One such occasion, however, happened to coincide with that national census they take every few years, when you get a form on which you must state the name of every person present in your dwelling place between dusk and dawn. Which is why the following morning a friend of hers, knowing that she was one of those women who are more punctilious about their civic responsibilities than their marital ones, rang her up and said, in some agitation, "Have you taken Leif off your senses?" Now, admit, weren't there times during that when you were muttering to yourself, "Where's all this leading to? I hope it's going to prove worthwhile." Well, if there's one thing that Frank and I have learned over the years, it's that providing the final twist is really satisfying, then one can ignore all the audience's whinging en route to it. Or as they used to say back in the days when they said it in Latin, the end jest defers the moans.
Well,
hang on a minute for Frank to work it out.
2 years.
Yeah. While he was working it out, the BBC's gas-fired computer crunched the numbers and revealed that our winners are Antonia and Dennis. So they each get two tins of My Word alphabet soup, while Dillis and Frank have to make do with some wordless minestrone. Until we all meet again, goodbye.